More and more of our daily lives are taking place on the internet. Our banking, socializing, record keeping, shopping, and more. After the recent data breaches at Target and Neiman Marcus that allowed hackers to access credit card information, many of us are wondering how secure and safe cyberspace is. So, for this week's Please Explain, we'll find out. Joining us is Peter W. Singer, director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institution, and co-author of the new book, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know, written with Alan Friedman and published by Oxford University Press. Mr. Singer, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
I just wanted to tell our listeners, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. You can also join in on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Mr. Singer, cybersecurity is a broad term, as you know, and I think most of us know it includes concerns of individuals who might shop online as well as concerns of the military and government. So does a data breach at a store also raise concerns about how secure our power grid is or our military systems are?
It's a great question because in one part of it, it hits how we too often lump lots of different things together, all because they're cyber attacks. And you can see this in, for example, the testimony that General Alexander, who's simultaneously the head of the NSA and Cyber Command, gave to Congress, where he talked about how the U.S. is under millions of cyber attacks every day. But to get those numbers, he was lumping together everything from address scans that never entered networks to attempts at kids carrying out some kind of fun prank to political protests to cyber crime attacks to espionage to you name it. They were lumping together so many of these different activities and saying they're all the same simply because they involve zeros and ones. It'd be a lot like how if you said, well, teenagers with firecrackers, political protesters with a smoke bomb, a criminal with a pistol, James Bond with his pistol, a terrorist with a bomb, and a Soviet cruise missile were all the same because they were all using gunpowder. So too often we lump these very different things together. But your underlying question about the vulnerability of systems in cyberspace, it is very real, and there are very real threats, whether you're talking about threats to you as an individual, threats to the businesses that you use or that you work in, all the way up to the national security level. One of the things that the recent breaches at Target or the other end of the department store spectrum, Neiman Marcus, also was apparently hit, it shows how while this is a space of seemingly software and hardware, it's the wetware that matters. It's the people. And these organizations are driven by people and their incentives. And at least what we're figuring out so far, it appears that they weren't taking some elements of cybersecurity as seriously as they should. And in turn, the customers, it depends on how seriously you were taking your own cybersecurity as to your own vulnerability from the ripple effects of these attacks.
Well, you raise an interesting point leading to a question I was just about to ask you, and that is do big companies like Target or, say, even Amazon, which is entirely online, do they take cybersecurity seriously?
It's not so much the size of the organization as opposed to the incentives. Again, it's all about the people. And so we see some business sectors are doing fairly well. And let me be very clear when I say fairly well. Too often people, search for perfection in this space, 100% security. And you'll see companies that, offer this. There's no such thing as 100% security, whether it's in, your regular life or your online life. And anybody who's, offering you that is, up to no good. But we do see some sectors, like the finance sector, that's doing a lot more on their own attempts, their internal cybersecurity, to how they share information with others. By contrast, we see other business sectors that aren't doing as much. That applies to, unfortunately, some parts of the critical infrastructure out there, you know, be it the water, power, et cetera. Also, it appears to consumer companies. And that is a good illustration of the role that government, I think, can and should play. In some situations, it should be, you know, an information provider, letting people know about threats and best responses to them. Other situations, it's got to be setting standards. And frankly, in other situations, just like it did with, you know, the nuclear power industry or, you know, cruise lines needing lifeboats, it set standards that were also backed up by law. And that created a different kind of incentives. The problem is, you know, again, this is, you know, just like the users of the internet, everybody's got to step up. Some companies have, some haven't, mm-hmm. but on the government side, Congress most certainly has not. We haven't seen major cybersecurity legislation since 2002. You know, that's 5 years before any of us heard of the iPhone, mm-hmm. let alone, you know, this current era of, you know, Google Glass to, you know, the topic of the president's speech today, metadata and the like.
Right. I'm Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Peter Singer, and we're talking about cybersecurity. And before we start talking, and Peter, I just want to let people know that they can find out more at cybersecuritybook.com. So, Peter, before we go into how sort of behind our national laws are to where our technology is, I want to go back to Target. And can you explain what happened and how it was possible? Because before we thought 70 million people, which is a lot, had been impacted by what happened at Target. But then today we find out that it wasn't 70 million. It was 110 million people who had their financial information, their credit card information taken by thieves. What happened?
Well, it's still playing out as we're discovering what happened. And that's a really good illustration of the problem of understanding these attacks and attribution of them and the like. Again, whether you're talking about an attack on a department store or you're talking about a cyber warfare level attack, it's not like the you know, easy figure it out of guy with gun walks into store, aha, that must be him and who committed the crime, or if we're thinking about in war, you know, the very clean, clear smoke trail from the missile coming at you. Mm-hmm. Aha, that's the missile, and that's who sent it. It's a different space. So a couple of things that stand out in the what happened story here. The first is this is not the first time. It appears that Wired magazine, for example, reported today that Target was hit in 2005 by similar attacks. More broadly, in the book, one of the things we explore is how 97% of Fortune 500 companies know that they've been hacked. And frankly, the other 3% have been too. They just haven't been willing to own up to it or understand it. So, you know, this is the kind of story that will continue to come again and again. It depends on how the companies react to it. The second is mm-hmm. the kind of attack that was carried out. It appears that it was sophisticated, but in a certain way. This was not, you know, a couple of teenagers doing something for giggles. They showed a pretty interesting level of coordination. So it wasn't merely about the technology they were using. In fact, it appears some of the technology was what they could have bought off of black markets, but there was the coordination of it that really, really stood out. This black market side, though, is important because it applies, again, to whether you're thinking about war or cybercrime. It's much like with, you know, with real world war, terrorism, or crime. It's going after the markets mm-hmm. and the underlying structures that matter rather than playing whack-a-mole going after the individuals. You know, so if you're thinking about the parallel of the drug trade, you know, you can go after the dealer on the street corner, but you're not going to mm-hmm. make much headway. It's much like that in cybercrime.
So,
one last thing to point out that's a big lesson for people. As you mentioned, the story of, you know, what's been coming out and how many people might be affected by this matters, but it also points to the very basics of cybersecurity we can do to protect yourself. And one of the things we talk about in the book is these very simple steps of cyber hygiene that matter whether you're a general, a diplomat, to a consumer. And one is, besides having strong passwords, to not reuse the same passwords across all of your accounts for just this very kind of situation, so that if it's lost in one account, they can't, what they call, daisy chain across your other accounts, mm-hmm. because the passwords are also what are being sold on these marketplaces. So don't use the same one again and again.
I have to ask you, who are these people who are stealing this information, and to what end?
Well, it's these people. It covers a wide framework when we're talking about the players here. So, if we're talking about in the realm of cybercrime, you have people that are conducting fraud, people that are trying to get you to click on a link so they can get more hit counts for their advertisement, other people that are trying to get you to click on a link to download spyware into your computer. You have people that are going after a broad-based attack over credit card numbers for a mass scale of people, and then they're selling those off to people that might be going after you individually. And what's interesting to me is this is just in focusing on what I just said, sort of the classic sort of criminal side, but that's only part of the story here. Our narrative around cybersecurity and cyber war has been mostly about these, cyber 9/11, cyber Pearl Harbor scenarios. In fact, there's been over 500,000 references of those in the media, and sort of the massive cyber attack, as President Obama talked about why we need to do certain activities in the speech today. But the reality is, those still remain their potential. The book explores this, but they still remain fictionalized scenarios. Versus, on one hand, cybercrime that we just talked about, but the bigger, larger part of cybercrime that concerns me on an economic and national security level is the huge campaign of intellectual property theft that's mostly emanating from China, mm-hmm. Where it's, by basically any measure, the largest theft in all of human history. In terms of its scale, in terms of its targets, the targets have ranged from defense companies to soft drink companies to small furniture companies in New England that lost the design of a chair they were looking to sell. But it's not just been the designs of things that have been stolen. It's been negotiating strategies to the personal cell phone numbers of White House staff, to the New York Times, as we explore in the book, was famously targeted, and they weren't going after the secret ink that the New York Times uses or what it was going to charge for its newspaper. It was trying to find out who was talking to New York Times reporters mm-hmm. about corruption in Chinese political families.
And we're talking about China. This is state sanction. What's happening in terms of, I think you called it the largest intellectual property theft in human history. Did I get that right?
It's the largest theft.
Theft.
Not just IP. If you're doing it by any kind of measure, it's arguably the largest theft in all of human history, and it's happening. Let me be very clear. The book explores what is and isn't cyber war and the new uses of this in military operations. It explores the terrorism side, the crime side. Those are all very real things that are playing out. But if we're looking at the scale of what should be more at the center of our discussion, as opposed to the power grid going down scenario, mm-hmm. let me put it a different way. Squirrels have taken down the power grid more times than hackers have. And yet that's what we're more comfortable talking about than this very real ongoing massive scale campaign.
Mm-hmm. But Peter, before we go to a break, you mentioned earlier cyber hygiene, and you talked about having strong passwords and not having the same password for everything. So I want to, what are some of the other ways we can protect ourselves?
So the book goes into this, and there's a variety of steps from, you know, many of them almost seem like parallel to preschool. Don't take candy from strangers. Mm-hmm. It's the very same thing. You shouldn't be taking hardware from strangers. You shouldn't be, you know, clicking on links from strangers that you don't know. To give you an illustration of the how this affects not just individual citizens, but at the highest levels of government, the most important foreign government penetration of classified U.S. military networks happened from a candy drop. The spy agency left memory sticks in the parking lot outside a U.S. military base. A soldier saw this shiny object in the dirt, thought it would be neat to take it inside and plug it into his computer, and it downloaded it. To diplomats at the G20 conference, the most important international conference of the year, received what they call a spear phishing email, where it had a link that enticed them into clicking because it said you're going to be able to see nude photos of the French First Lady. And instead, they didn't get their photos, but they did download spyware into their computers. What I'm getting at here more broadly, you know, these are all kind of fun, somewhat silly, somewhat scary stories. More broadly, this notion of hygiene is not just about the basic preventative steps that you can do to protect yourself, but it's also, I like it because of the parallel of the ethic of responsibility that we need to be building. So think about it this way. I teach my kids to wash their hands, cover their mouth when they cough, not just to protect themselves, but to protect everyone else that they come into contact with through the day. That's the same kind of ethic of responsibility we need to build in our online world. Again, whether you're talking about you and your kids or you're reaching up to a higher level of corporations or national governments, we have a collective responsibility here. And that's what I'd like to see a little bit more woven into our discussions than some of the hype, fear, misunderstanding, and ignorance that's put us in this place right now.
I'm speaking with Peter W. Singer, the director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence. We're talking about cybersecurity and how to protect your personal information online. And if you have a question, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Leave a comment on our show page or find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is @LeonardLopate. We'll be back with more after a break. I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm speaking with Peter Singer about cybersecurity. And Peter, I want to go to a question I believe we got on our show page from Priscilla in Harlem. She writes, "Just this morning, I got an email from Target," and she asks, "or was it phishing?" from Target, related to the security breach, offering a free year of credit monitoring from Experian. Should I trust this email? Would a credit monitoring service really protect me from this kind of breach happening again?
So first, I'm going to be very careful to I'm not going to try and be one of those, you know, the equivalent would be the doctors who come on to radio shows to talk about a broad thing and then, you know, get stuck diagnosing people's individual problems. So
right.
I'm going to try and not do that. But this Target question is interesting because it's already popped up in the news as a illustration of some of the challenges that Target has had in dealing with this issue, and frankly how some of them have been self-inflicted in its response afterwards. You already mentioned one of it, which was this changing story about the scale of it, how initially it affected roughly 30 million people. Then a couple days later it was, actually it was 70 million plus. And then yet again next, oh goodness, you know what? Actually now it's more than 100 million. And if you're thinking about the public affairs side of a company that faces situations like this, initially you're wanting to control the information, but it yields these, you know, news stories that hurt you more in the end. Next, you have this question about the response, and there have been several news outlets that have explored just this question here of how so many people have confused the email that was sent out as either spam or potentially phishing. And there's some some ways they went about it that made it more likely to be interpreted that way, that we're probably not, you know, I don't think we're going to see this described as best practice by any way, shape, or form. So that's a problem. Next, you have the question they had of the offer that was given. It's good. It's important for people to constantly be, you know, looking after their credit and the like, you know, if they've been involved in situations like this. But by no means should you consider it the only thing to protect yourself. And of course, we just talked about how to, you know, in situations like this, it's not merely about that one single account. It's also about the ripple effects that it might be having on your other accounts. So there's a series of lessons that we explore in the book. One of the biggest ones is besides thinking about, you know, your external line of defense, you know, be it your password or whatever, it's more importantly about changing it to a mentality of resilience. And resilience is, instead of, you know, thinking about building up walls or the like, it's about expecting that bad things are going to happen. And it's more about how are you preparing for them and how are you preparing to bounce back from them quickly. So if you think about, you know, the human body is one of the most resilient structures out there. It's got an external line of defense. It's got your skin. But it also has ways to act if it expects that the skin will get cut, and it goes after it, and everything from, you know, closing that off to it's got internal monitoring that's going on, watching for anomalies. It can triage things, et cetera. Same thing when it comes to psychological resilience. You know, the British saying of, you know, keep calm and carry on. That's what we ought to be, the mentality that we should have. What, again, whether we're talking about a hack of your credit card to these bigger, scarier scenarios of cyber terrorism or the like, it's our reactions to it that will truly determine the consequences, not just the direct impact.
So, Peter, one of the things Priscilla mentioned in her note was, you know, being offered monitoring from Experian. But in the fall, Experian was scammed by an identity theft service where it sold information, including social security numbers, driver's license numbers, and banking and credit card numbers to what it thought was a private investigator. And this seems like a major major problem of oversight on Experian's part. But what does it mean for the people affected?
Well, again, it's any there is no 100% security. There's no silver bullet solution. There's no secret sauce. There's no, and anyone who is offering that to you with the idea that it is 100% is, you know, simply taking advantage of you. And that's I'm not making this statement about a single company. You could equally apply it to our national security discourse and you know, the unfortunately too often sort of the man on horseback mentality that we've had of get scared. There's many dangerous things that might happen, which is quite true. There are many dangerous things that might happen, but we you know, in almost like the movie Spinal Tap, we turn the volume up to 11, and then the next step is they go, oh, and by the way, the solution to this is to spend more on my agency budget, to give me more power, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We've, for example, seen a doubling of spending on military cyber in a period of where the rest of the budget's going down. That spending we should be spending more, but we also need to have a balance towards it. So, for example, we're spending about 10 times as much on military cyber as we are at the civilian side and Department of Homeland Security. But then let me hit one other part of you were asking there. I said, oh, my goodness, they things like your Social Security number got out there. Well, in the book, you know, we tell this fun little story about how there's a professor who all he needs to know is your date of birth and what state you're from, and within a couple of guesses, he can figure out your Social Security number. There's this sort of assumption that Social Security numbers are this secret thing used for identity, and the reality is, go back and look at it. It says, you know, not to be used that way. It's basically its origin is it's a series of numbers linked to you that allowed people to handle records more effectively than you know, John Smith, because there's lots of John Smiths, and so we need to, you know, not have this singular approach to security, like I talked about, it's the idea of resilience, or it's the idea of another thing we explore is, you know, multi-factor, which sounds really strange and complicated. This all seems really techie. Just think about your bank card, your ATM card. It depends on both something that you know, your password, but it also depends on you physically possessing that object. Mm-hmm. We need similar kind of approaches. You should have that for your email accounts, your Gmail or the like. We need to implement it in other areas like our credit cards.
Well, Peter, in terms of passwords, I want to go to a call from Elliot in Boonton, New Jersey. Elliot, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
What's your question for Peter?
My question is, I have a long list of passwords, and because conventional wisdom is that I should have different passwords, but I have to have them in a list somewhere. So there's a stealth name for that list, and I keep it in an encrypted Word file that is in the Windows desktop encrypted safe. And now that you know my name and where I'm from, I'm
looking up your passwords right now, and I really enjoy them.
So, Elliot, your question.
Is that safe enough?
So,
a stealthy named file that's an encrypted document that's in the Windows encrypted desktop safe. Is that a safe vault for my list of passwords?
Let me say it sort of three ways here. So the first is it's good that you're doing much, much more than the average bear. And the best illustration of this would be the fact that the most common password out there is actually password. Yeah. And the second most common is 12345. And then we already talked about the fact of how people use the same passwords again and again over their different accounts. So one, it's good that you're doing that. Two, it's not a perfect line of defense, and that's true whether someone who is directly going after you or the fact that they may be going after the company or the like that's the holders of those passwords. Another part of this is that the attacks might not go directly after your password, but go after a password reset that you might never see. So they'll contact the organization and say, I've forgotten my password. Can I do a reset? And then, you know, they often have these fairly easy to find out answer to secondary questions like, you know, what's your mother's maiden name, which is often easy to look up. And so we in the book, for example, both advise the companies of they need to get much more sophisticated in that, but also to us, we need to be giving answers that aren't easy to run down. So the what's your mother's maiden name, give something that's frankly from a different kind of question, like, you know, your pet's first name or whatever. The third part of this is the challenge that people talk about of how, gosh, I can't remember all of these different passwords that are out there. How can I do that? And one is that there's some new technologies called password managers, and those are some things to explore. But, of course, those equally can be gone after. The other, as I mentioned, is we need to see more of a move towards multi-factor. And many of these accounts that you're talking about, I'm guessing, might have the possibility of a multi-factor approach, which is basically, you know, an illustration would be your Gmail, how it might have a rotating password, but then they text it to your phone to check that you're the person. Mm. So to get into it, that person has a much more difficult. But again, nothing that I said is 100% secure, and no one should think about it that way.
I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate. And we're talking with Peter Singer about cybersecurity. And Peter, we're going to go to a question from Amy in Glen Cove.
Hi.
Hi.
My question pretty much dovetails on what you were just saying, and I was wondering about those online password holding sites where you put in all of your passwords and then they give you just one single password to utilize, and I'm guessing that that's just as hackable as anything else, but I was wondering what your opinion of it was.
Thanks, Amy.
Thanks.
Well, it's funny, though. Let me just make a quick comment. It's interesting, you know, this illustrates the importance of this field, how it's a field that connects everything from our own concerns about our privacy, our passwords for anything from our bank accounts to our, you know, our favorite online kid photos, but also it connects to these larger concerns of national security, war, you know, in the book, we're talking about everything from these questions to how this is affecting U.S.-China relations, to terrorism and the like. And that, to me, illustrates the both importance of the field, but also how long we have to go in terms of our understanding of it. And the interesting enough, the president himself, President Obama, reportedly was briefed on cyber issues and got exasperated and asked for it repeated back to him, quote, this time in English. So, you know, I'm making a larger comment about this topic and how crucial it is for us as individuals all the way up to as a nation. To the question that was asked about password managers, you hit it right. They offer convenience. They offer a greater level of security than sometimes what you and I can do, mainly because that's their business. And so they have an interest in being better at it. They have an expertise level in being better at it. But that makes them also a target. And so don't think that that's the only thing that you ought to be doing. It's something, but it's a lot like, you know, if you're thinking about your house, would you say, oh, goodness, I have, you would not say, well, I've got an alarm system. I don't need to lock my door, or I don't need to close my windows. We need to have a more broad-based approach to it, and that applies equally to you thinking about your account, to the companies that you're in, which range from, you know, large Fortune 500 companies to a cupcake store. If you're online, you will always have cybersecurity threats and issues to figure out, and so we need to change our mentality on it from, you know, being unaware to we've got to manage it. And that was the point of the book, is to try and make it easy for people to understand and also tell some fun stories along the way. So you know, the story about how the internet works, we used the episode of where Pakistan accidentally stole all the world's cute cat videos to kick it off.
Peter, should we just get rid of passwords and just use a fingerprint reader to get into everything?
No, because as we explore in the book, that's been hackable too, either through the back door side to some people have used gummy bears to spoof it to, you know, Russian mobsters are not fan of gummy bears, so they've used other things to
gummy bears?
Get the fingerprint there. But it is a good illustration of what I was talking about before, of a multi-factor approach. A multi-factor basically means something that you are, something that you know, something that you have. So it's the something that you are as a biometric, like a fingerprint, something that you know as a password, something that you have as like your ATM card. And again, they're not perfect, but each layer makes it more difficult for that attacker, and it means they've got to spend more time going after it.
Peter, real fast, in 20 seconds, gummy bears, how are explain? 20 seconds.
Press your finger in a gummy bear.
Ah, that makes a lot of sense. I've been speaking with Peter Singer, director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. He's the co-author of Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. More information at cybersecuritybook.com. Peter, thanks again.
Appreciate you having me.